Okay, so a warm welcome to Asha, who's going to be talking about another different animal space.
Thank you very much. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about a chapter from my research. It is on Victorian vivisection. So in 1863, The Lancet, which is a 19th century medical journal, estimated that perhaps some two or three, or at most six scientific men in London occasionally vivisected. But by the end of the decade, the numbers of experiments and experimenters had risen dramatically. The rise of these practitioners troubled the anti-vivisection movement, which was in full swing by the mid-1870s. And as this camp grew more vocal, practical physiologists complained that misplaced feelings were dictating and constraining laboratory research. They were backed by the medical press, which dismissed the lay public as sentimental and branded anti-vivisectionists hysterical. Until recently, commentators have continued in this vein by pathologizing the hidden motivations and emotions of those who opposed experimental science, whilst taking at face value the vivisector's ability to banish such feelings from clinical studies. Although many experimenters insisted that one could be a dispassionate scientist within the workplace and a dog lover outside laboratory walls, anti-vivisectionists remained intensely fascinated by the vivisector's emotional life and wondered what motivated his work. While scholars have been curiously content with what Paul White terms transparent readings of historical sources concerning the inner feelings of medical experimenters, anti-vivisectionists did not regard sources such as scientific textbooks and monographs as a neutral discourse. The movement's leaders, such as Francis Power Cobb, urged supporters to study the facts, the actual cruelties, as described by physiologists themselves. Cobb particularly advocated careful and incisive reading, which, she claimed, offered the layperson a key to the laboratory and helped uncover the true relationship between the scientist and his animal subject. This paper re-examines those scientific texts which were the most intensely scrutinized. It particularly explores how readers were encouraged to detect and dissect moments of preoccupation and absorption. As the experimentalist describes delving into deeper parts of the animal's body, he seems to unconsciously expose hidden aspects of himself. So in 1877, the Home Chronicler, an independent anti-vivisection periodical, published the anonymous fill-in-the-blank poem, Punch Among the Vivisectors. Sorry, I skipped on one. The poem splices Punch the Puppet with Punch the Publication and imagines the dog Toby undergoing experiments. The verses directly refer to three physiologists and obliquely to one more. To identify them and complete the poem puzzle, the reader needed to be au fait with a range of ancillary documents, such as daily newspapers, physiology textbooks, and government reports. Two Scottish physiologists and physicians, Sir William Rutherford, or Rufus Rutherford, who's popped up there, and Sir Thomas Lord of Brunton, come under fire. The former is condemned for his infamous canine starvation trials, whilst the latter is derided for omitting certain tests when asked at the 1875 Royal Commission on Vivisection how many cats he'd used. Hence the line, another seven might decide whether it is best to bake or starve him. Reference to baking recalls the French vivisectionist Claude Bernard's revolved mechanism for studying death by heat, as well as his famous metaphor of the laboratory as a long and ghastly kitchen through which one must pass in order to reach the dazzling lighted hall of scientific revelation. Finally, Croatian-born Emmanuel Klein, sometimes known as the father of British microbiology, is mocked for using curare, which is a drug that paralyzes without anesthetizing, to prevent agonized animals from biting or scratching him. As the detailed knowledge required to decode poems like Punch Among the Vivisectors indicates, anti-vivisectionists engage critically with dry and lengthy scientific documents. One of the early texts to be pounced upon and picked apart was the Handbook for the Physiological Laboratory, the first practical physiological manual in the English language, published in 1873. We've already met two of its four co-authors in the poem, Emmanuel Klein and Thomas Lord of Brunton, who are joined by John Burden Sanderson, UCL's Professor of Physiology, and Michael Foster from Trinity College, Cambridge. Published before the formation of an organised anti-vivisection movement, they hardly expected to reach many readers beyond academic and professional circles. Indeed, Burden Sanderson's preface specifically targets beginners in physiological works and emphasizes that the book is practical, better suited to the laboratory than the study. The manual would have remained relatively obscure if it weren't for George Hogan, a reformed laboratory assistant, who in 1875 brought unprecedented attention to the alleged cruelties of experimental science by writing a letter about his harrowing experiences to the Morning Post. Hogan warned that the public knew no more about the cruelties of vivisection than that which the distant echo reflected from some handbook the laboratory affords. This statement implicated the 1873 handbook, and by suggesting that written accounts were shadows of actual practice, Hogan invited a closer scrutiny of vivisectors' claims. He alleged that in Claude Bernard's laboratory, dogs were brought up from cellars for experiments which make friendly advances and mute appeals for mercy eloquent through eyes, ear, and tail. Even when roughly grasped and thrown on the torture trough, he claimed, a low complaining whine at such treatment would be all the protest made, and they would continue to lick the hand which bound them till their mouths were fixed in the gag, and they could only flap their tail in the trough as their last means of exciting compassion. Were the feelings of experimental physiologists not blunted, he wrote, they could not long continue the practice of vivisection. They are always ready to repudiate any implied want of tender feeling, he alleged, yet seldom show much pity. On the contrary, he said, in practice they frequently show the reverse. Hundreds of times I have seen when an animal writhed with pain and thereby deranged the tissues during a delicate dissection, instead of being soothed, it would receive a slap and an angry order to be quiet and behave itself. By theorizing that vivisection blunts rather than erases tender emotions, and by contrasting what experimentalists say to what they show in practice, Hogan connected the secrecy surrounding the nature and extent of experiments with the physiologist's shrouded inner feelings. Following Hogan's letter, the handbook was met with hostility. Richard Holt Hutton, editor of The Spectator and an anti-vivisectionist, warned that it was dangerous to society. Its ominous appearance, the Saturday Review echoed, symbolised the introduction into England of a new moral contagion, importing not only the practices, but the principles of experimental science from France and Germany. Many anti-vivisection periodicals returned to the handbook to perform their own detective work. Burden Sanderson's description of an asphyxia experiment elicited the following response from the Zoophilist, a periodical published by the anti-vivisectionist Victoria Street Society. And you might have to forgive me if I mispronounce some of these words. The whole large volume is in the form of a receipt book for cookery, e.g. proceed as above, divide the lingual nerve, a cannula having been placed in the carotid, a second manometer is placed. For this purpose, asphyxia, a cannula must be fixed airtight in the trachea. In these spasms, which accompany the final gasps of an asphyxiated animal, the head is thrown back and they must be carefully distinguished by the student from the expiratory convulsions previously described. The passage is striking in at least two ways. Firstly, through the equipment it lingers on. The Zoophilist replicates the operator's supposedly unfeeling, detached gaze by emphasizing two registering machines, a mercurial manometer and a chymograph, which measure pressure and gas. New kinds of recording or registering machines, such as the cardiograph, spirograph, and pneumograph, were appearing in England at the time of the handbook's publication and were vigorously promoted by its editor, Burden Sanderson. Unlike other physiology textbooks, such as Claude Bernard's L'Ecant de Physiologie Opératoire, the handbook rarely depicted vivisections and instead showed physiological equipment in isolation from the animal body. The animal subject, White notes, was addressed only insofar as it was secured to the table. Thereafter, concern was given entirely to the manipulation of registering machines, scalpels, forceps, and hooks, and to the intricacy of operations. Michael Lynch suggests that this ritualistic bodily erasure transforms the singular animal into what he calls a bearer of transcendental significances, or, as White puts it, into a universal or sacred ideal, a body of knowledge. If the animal is reimagined as this repository of meaning, the chymograph, meaning wave writer, appears to translate its import. A revolving drum is wrapped in a sheet of paper upon which a stylus records its change in pressure or motion. During progressive stages of suffocation, physiological changes are tricky to distinguish from the animal's emotional distress. Thus, the chymograph seems to write out the animal's spasms, convulsions, and arching neck, which appear on the page as a tale of pain, or at least this is how the anti-vivisectionists were presenting it in this article. So here, the vivisector becomes author of the animal's agony and reader of its effects. an interpreter and translator of his own text. His carelessness for the animal's anguish is juxtaposed with his careful observation of and appreciation for the inanimate precision machine. Secondly, the Zoophilist's review of the handbook extends and thereby ridicules Claude Bernard's culinary metaphor of the laboratory as a long and ghastly kitchen by likening the handbook to a cookery manual and scientific operations to domestic work. These blurrings contradict Burton Sanderson's separation of scientific or domestic space, or as he put it, the laboratory and the study, suggest that lay readers can interpret the handbook and cast the vivisector's clinical attitude as a threat to the tender emotions that the poem connotes. The article executes another spatial sleight of hand by stressing the material kitchen whilst removing altogether Bernard's transcendental, dazzling lighted hall. Colin Milburn explains that for Bernard, the laboratory operates as a book of blood, promising meaning and the light of truth on the other side, but appearing on its crimson surface as nothing so much as a butcher's block, the wet and grisly place where the cutting up of animals might also entail cooking and eating them. By removing its adjoining passage, the Zoophilist denies the laboratory's status as the space of the signifier and asserts that in this case at least, the open animal body offers up no physiological meaning but merely satisfies the experimenter's unmentionable appetite. Cookery comes into play in yet another incident. In 1875, a royal commission called 53 witnesses to assess the case for the restriction of vivisection. But handbook contributor Klein single-handedly ended any hope that legislation might be avoided. When quizzed about the problem of painful experiments, Klein replied, "Just as little as a sportsman or a cook goes inquiring into the detail of the whole business, while the sportsman is hunting or the cook putting a lobster into boiling water. Just as little can the physiologist or the investigator be expected to devote time and thought to inquiring what this animal will feel while he's doing the experiment. The physiologist's whole attention," Klein explained, "is only directed to the making of the experiment, how to do it quickly, and to learn the most he can from it." When shocked commissioners requested clarification, Klein reasserted that he had no regard for the suffering of experimental animals. Detached and disinterested, Klein epitomised scientific cruelty. "Intense pain, almost too dreadful to gaze on," James Turner writes, he seemed ready to inflict with neither qualm nor shudder. When pro-vivisection members of the commission were also unnerved, T.H. Huxley condemned Klein's mischievously brutal talk and lamented the impact it would have on their case. This claim to have no regard for animal suffering parallels the attitude of Klein's mentor, Claude Bernard, who famously declared, "A physiologist is no ordinary man. He is a scientist, possessed and absorbed by the scientific idea that he pursues. He does not hear the cries of the animals. He does not see their flowing blood. He sees nothing but his idea." But whilst Bernard's see-nothing stance ostensibly represents clinical detachment, the calm objectivity this vivisector described is contradicted by the language he employs. His biographer, Frederick Holmes, tentatively admits that Bernard reacted to his scientific work with more intense feeling than he would afterward have others believe. When extolling the physiologist's ability to focus on the scientific idea, vocabulary like possession and absorption conflated the need for concentration with the pleasure of oblivion. Activists remained suspicious that the vivisector's objectivity was a mask for his sadism. They found another supposed chink in the disguise when scouring Russian physiologist Lidisyon's Methodique, a well-regarded sourcebook for researchers and physicians. The Home Chronicler regularly reproduced facsimiles of the book's gruesome illustrations, whilst the Zoophilist, another anti-vivisection periodical, frequently reprinted the following passage, which is even read aloud at Victoria Street Society meetings. "The true vivisector," Sion confidently stated, "must approach a difficult vivisection with joyful excitement and delight. He who approaches a vivisection as an unpleasant necessity will never become an artist in vivisection. He who cannot follow some fine nerve thread, scarcely visible to the naked eye, with joyful alertness for hours at a time, he who feels no enjoyment when at last parted from its surroundings and isolated, he can subject that nerve to electrical stimulation," etc., etc., etc. "To such a one there is wanting that which is most necessary for a successful vivisector." At first, Sion's ideal physiologist appears distanced from the animal via a Bernard-like and blinkered focus on the scientific idea and particular body parts. Nevertheless, by using metaphors of artistry and repetitious descriptions of extracting and electrocuting the fine nerve thread, Sion, perhaps unwittingly, knitted together the experimenter's joyful excitement and delight with the animal's agony. Suddenly, feelings are not at all distant, but close, integral even, to animal research. Research which he described in terms befitting a heroic quest, complete with the same pleasure of discovery. Just like any other investigator, he insisted, the vivisector finds a keen moral satisfaction when, after vanquishing the many difficulties of the experiments, he at last discovers some new function and finds his arduous efforts crowned with success. Sion countered anti-vivisectionist criticism by claiming that the satisfaction of overcoming technical difficulties had been misconstrued. How distant is the feeling either of cruelty or of compassion, he clarified, from the motives which decide the physiologist to perform a vivisection. He also attacked his opponents, whom he labelled hypocritical humbugs and hysterical old maids, intent on hindering and humiliating researchers. His British colleagues tended to adopt less combative approaches. Some insisted that vivisection was upsetting for the operator as well as the animal, whilst others, such as Lord of Brunton and Claude Bernard, endeavoured to explain the disconnect between the vivisector's cruel exterior and his humane heart by likening themselves to surgeons. Those who do not shudder or pale at suffering, Brunton explained, have simply learned to disregard their own feelings and to concentrate their attention on the interests of the patient. They are guided no longer by emotion, but by judgment. Many drew on similarly heroic and sometimes military modes which emphasized the manly control of emotion in the fight against disease. Paul White comments that this gave a legitimate and triumphalist gloss to the kinds of passions that their critics denigrated as selfish and inhumane. But Brunton's assurances were difficult to square with the defiance displayed by physiologists such as Charles Richet, who claimed that vivisectors cut the spinal marrow of dogs and poisoned frogs to resolve obscure details rather than cure disease. Scientific curiosity alone animates the experimentalist, Richet explained. And I quote, "This is why we pass our days in fetid laboratories surrounded by the groaning creatures in the midst of blood and suffering, bent over palpitating entrails." These contradictions and circumlocutions seemed deceitful and bolstered a discourse of diablerie. Anti-vivisectionist periodicals termed physiologists human monsters, scientific barbarians, and human demons, and condemned their practice as a vile pursuit, cruel quackery, and scientific torture. And this terminology was reiterated in parts of the wider press. The 1876 Cruelty to Animals Act and the formation of an organized anti-vivisection movement awakened a sense of esprit de corps amongst a small band of British physiologists. Members of this assailed profession, aware that their publications had become fodder for their opponents' assaults, began to guard research trials more closely, reduced public access to lectures and laboratories, and formed clubs such as the Physiological Society of Great Britain. As the initial openness with which physiologists wrote and spoke about their work declined, their adversaries resorted to reprinting and recirculating the same incriminatory passages across protest pamphlets and periodicals. Even so, anti-vivisectionist publications couldn't quite pin down the character that they had, in part, created, and contradictorily claimed that Bernard and his brethren delighted and were disinterested in pain right up until they petered out of print. In fact, one of the few characterizations which stuck was that, as Bernard had always said, the physiologist is no ordinary man.